All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck buddies? What the fucksters? What's happening? How's it going? I'm Mark Maron. This is my podcast, WTF. Welcome to it. I imagine some of you are new to this show after last week's David Letterman interview. Welcome. Welcome to the show. This is the part where I talk a bit about myself and ask how you're doing. Sometimes it gets you caught up on my life. That can happen. Sometimes I tell you what's going on in my mind. Sometimes I get aggravated about the cultural and political situation in our country and world right now. Yeah, so that's what's up. I'm Mark. How are you? Thanks for coming by. I'm glad you liked that interview last week. A lot of people did. First off, John Turturro is on the show today, and I'd like to give you a little background on that because I had one of the rare, near meltdowns during that interview. I almost lost my shit in front of an amazing actor, and I wasn't acting. A sweat broke, things came unglued. I'll tell you about it in a minute, but let's stay with what I'm dealing with right now. What's going on? Which is a couple of things I need to address here at the outset. Is this the outset? It was a little misunderstood, but it was also on me in referring to AA, Alcoholics Anonymous, which is the program that I got sober in. I don't think it was glibly, but I said it's the only thing, I said to Dave in reference to his experience with his father that, it's really the only option. And it's just old school thinking. I know it's not the only option. And I just want to, and some people push back on this. I got some emails and I think that, it might be discouraging to people who are trying to get sober if they think that's it, if they didn't have a good experience in those rooms or it's not for them or whatever. And I think they were right in telling me that by saying it's the only option, it doesn't help. It might make people hopeless. And here's what I got to say on that. That's true. There are other options. You should investigate whatever option you want and whatever fucking works, fucking do it. Whatever you got to do to save your life from addiction, from alcoholism, for whatever compulsion that is destroying it, do it if it's safe and it's not going to cause more trouble. I don't judge anybody. There's many people who've gotten sober with nothing. Who have gotten, just white knuckled it or whatever. Whatever your perception is of any process of recovery, great. For me, it was just AA. It's just easy. I go. They're all over the place. You show up on any given day. There's usually many. No one asks you any questions. You walk in. You sit down. Nothing. But it's old school stuff. And sometimes that whatever that has to offer, it may not be for you. But I do want to make it clear that there are other ways, and honestly, whatever you have to fucking do, just to get through a day, there's no judgment here, and I can only say what worked for me, but again, there are other ways, and investigate whatever you need to investigate, do whatever you got to do to get that day sober, and hopefully a string of days. That's my statement on that. Thank you for the input, people who were aggravated. The other thing, less pressing, is that on the Letterman interview, I talked about my first appearance in my shiny suit. Turns out that was the second appearance. I went back and looked at him. Some kid had posted, I don't know who he is. Someone had put up four of the appearances. I believe there were five in total. There were four stand-ups and one panel. But the shiny suit was definitely the second one because I watched the first one and I'm like, oh yeah, that horrible thing. That terrible moment in the black suit. I was a little shaky. I remember that I'd gotten myself sick before because I was so nervous, which I used to do a lot. Anything that I had to do that was a big deal, I would stress out to the point where I would make myself ill. And I remember I was getting a cold and I was like worried about my voice and I was backstage and Biff was about to pull the curtain aside and I was like, I don't feel well. Is there a Kleenex? And that was the first one. And it was okay, but I had put it out of my mind. It's interesting how the mind works. I don't know how old you are or whether this is because of age, but I don't know how I got through almost anything back in the day. I really don't. My memories, as they get further away, like there's some parts of my life where I'm like, I don't even know who that guy was. When I watch him, I'm like, oh, that's me. But it's like, I have to sort of engage in some sort of attempt at empathy for my younger self. Because like, I was like in constant anxiety, in constant aggravation and anger and self-loathing and just volatile and self-involved. Okay. Yeah, some of those things I still have. They're tempered, but I don't know, man. I know how I got here, but I'm amazed. I think that I'm here, and I can't really believe it's happening. And I try to engage in some gratitude and show up the best I can for other people. That I try to live a good life. And it's not easy when your brain is a fucking ball of snakes. Also, you know, I tried to have a private life, and I know that the relationship I have with many of you is visceral and it's connected and it's emotional, which it is, and I do share a lot of my life, but I do try to have a private life, and you know, I'm trying to separate. You know, there was a long period of time where, you know, anything that went on in my life and in my mind, I would dump onto these mics without really taking into consideration, you know, what it would mean to me or what it would mean to other people that, you know, may be involved in my life. So, you know, I try to, you know, maintain a private life. It's something I had to learn to do, and I hope you respect that. That being said, I should tell you that Sarah and I split up a while ago, and I've been sort of going through that period and that process and that sadness, and it's sort of having I do want to have a private life, and it is my business, but a lot of you are part of my narrative in the way that I allow you into my life, and I thought I would tell you that. And it's been a difficult few months, and it's gotten me into a state of like really thinking about my life, my relationships, you know, throughout my life with everybody. And I don't think it's a midlife thing, but it's something. There's just something about me trying to land in my life and decide how I want to live the rest of it that's been sort of, you know, pressing on me. And because of that, I've been doing a lot of reading. I've been doing a lot of, you know, reflecting. I've been doing a few meetings, and I've been, you know, talking to people. And, you know, just really trying to keep my heart above water and try to sort of change some patterns in my life, you know, around my ability to enjoy it. Okay? All right? I'm okay. And, you know, we move on. This is humans. This is humans. Humans do things. It's an amazing thing, these conversations that I have with people. And to be honest with you, I don't always know how they're going to be received. I know my experience of them, and I get very immersed in them. And while I'm doing it, I'm not thinking about you guys. I'm in it. I'm having a conversation, and I'm following how that goes, and, you know, I'm just kind of rolling with the conversation. And that's the thing about when I do these things on the road, the John Turturro talk, which you're about to hear, he's, you know, he's in a show, The Name of the Rose. It's airing on Sundance, and you can watch episodes on their streaming service, Sundance Now, or at sundancetv.com. But, you know, he's a great actor. I love the guy. And, you know, sometimes people don't come out to L.A. And I take it to them. I have a rig that I work with. I bring it on the road to do intros. And sometimes when I'm in New York, I'll do interviews. And sometimes if they're on location, Brendan, my producer, will meet me and we'll set up a mini studio. But other times it's like, yeah, I'm all right. We can just hang out in the room, in the hotel room. And it's fine. It's a little odd, you know, because I'm not staying usually at giant suites or anything. So we're just sitting there in the hotel room. But, you know, Turturro, John came over and we met in the lobby, and, you know, he's an excitable guy. And he's an intense guy and he likes to talk. And it was just one of these, like, these situations where, and you're not going to hear this most likely, but I do want to share the experience with you, is that, you know, I was recording and, you know, I was getting obsessed with him, you know, moving the mic around because, you know, I take it for granted that people are used to using a mic, holding a mic. And then I looked down at my recorder and I noticed that it was not recording. It had stopped recording. And I didn't know how long it had stopped for. We'd been going for a while. And it was just like that moment. And I don't experience too many moments like this in my life anymore where you're like, oh my God. So, you know, it's like, you could experience these moments all you want. It's something, you know, seemingly in my control, just did something. And now I have no control over what's happened, and I don't know how much I've missed or what's going on. So in that moment, I started to spin. And John's sitting there, and I'm like, fuck. And then I got to take the card out, and I got to stick the card in the computer to see what I have and pull that up. And then I got to, you know, figure out. It was my fault. The fucking card filled up. And I, you know, fortunately, I had another card, but like I had to figure out, you know, what the gap was. And he's watching me through all this. And I'm like, oh my God, this never happened. This never happened before. And it hasn't. I've lost an episode or two by accident years ago, but this never happened. And I'm kind of freaking out. And I'm like, and there's that moment in life where you're like, ah, fuck it. You know what? Let's forget it. Just, I can't do it. I can't just, you know, I'm sorry. Just go home. I appreciate it, and it's my fault, and I'm an asshole, and I fucked up, and I don't know how we can do it again. And I don't know if we're going to get through it or whatever. And it's an odd sort of situation to have a guest going like, it's okay, just take it easy. I'm like, no, man, it's like, I can't. And then I realized, dude, you've been doing this, you know, like a long time now. Just, you know, pull it together, you know, lock back in. Get started again. Don't, you know, you don't need to sit here in front of John Turturro and beat the shit out of yourself. And, you know, that's what happened. I was like, okay, all right, we're good. Let's just start from this place and, you know, kind of get back into it. And we did, but it was, it hadn't happened in a long time. There's a couple of things that have happened in the last year that haven't happened in a long time. That one and the flop sweat at the Comedy Cellar. Flop sweat at the Comedy Cellar. You're never, when things get away from you, and you know, there's that, and I was talking about this with a friend of mine where you have those moments where like your body and your brain, probably rightfully so, is like, just get out of here. Just get, walk away from it. You know, when something has gotten, you know, like you made a horrible mistake that fucks your job up, there's part of you that's just sort of like, I'm just going to go. I'm an asshole. I'm going to leave. Okay. Good luck with everything. Or when you're on stage and you're not doing well, it's sort of like, you feel that sweat on the back of your neck. There's definitely part of you that wants to just be like, all right, I'm going to go ahead and leave now. You don't like me. I'm out. Okay. I'm never going to do this again. And, you know, as time goes on, you get older, you realize, like, you know, ride it out, man. Just got to ride. But I'm like that with brushing my teeth, where really I've had to figure out, I think there were years in my life where I'm just sort of like, I'm not going to brush my teeth. I'm going to go to bed without brushing my teeth. You know, I'm not going to get up at a reasonable hour. And I just had to train myself to just do it. Just stay in it. Just do the thing. You know, don't, because a lot of times you're just not doing things so you have something to beat yourself up about. What's easier than brushing your fucking teeth when you go to bed? Now I'm compulsive about it. I'm like a floss freak. The point is, like, you know, make yourself do things that you should be doing because you should, and just make a habit of it so you can take that off the list out of reasons why you're an idiot. That's my self-help tip today. And also the Turturro thing worked out. But yeah, it was like, you know, I freaked out a little, folks. I'll be honest with you. I freaked out a little. So now I will share with you the conversation I had that I freaked out in the middle of with the amazing actor, John Turturro, who's a great guy, intense, smart, engaged man. And his show, The Name of the Rose, you can stream now on Sundance Now. It's on Sundance. You can also see it at SundanceTV.com. and it's airing on Sundance. So this is me in a New York City hotel room with John Turturro. You remember that place?
I mean, I used to
Amato's Opera.
Friends of my parents performed there.
What was that place? Because
it was a little opera house.
Yeah,
and a lot of really good singers came out of there, and then they went, you know, further on. And some people just, you know, they didn't get paid to do the operas, but there was something kind of old world, intimate, because this neighborhoods, these neighborhoods around here, had all these little ethnic theaters.
If you see
the history of it, like on Grand Street, I don't know between where and the center, I guess east of center, there was the Grand Street Theater. That was the Broadway theater before there was any Broadway. And so like in the...
Was it Yiddish?
They would do, would do King Lear like in Yiddish.
Yeah.
Then they'd leave the set and then they would do it in Italian.
Really?
Yeah.
The same actors?
No. Different actors, okay. Same set.
Okay.
So they had a lot of these, they had like Sicilian theaters, Neapolitan theaters, Yiddish theaters, German theaters, Poopy theaters, puppet theaters.
The movie theaters up there were all Yiddish theaters.
That was Yiddish, the Yiddish theater. Yeah. Second Avenue, that was the Yiddish theater over there, yeah. And like 11th Street, that's Intermedia. It was the Intermedia, and now it's the movie theater.
Right. That sounds like an amazing movie idea, to have the two troops doing Lear in Yiddish and in Italian.
Yeah, well, because everyone, that was their entertainment in their own language.
And this was the Lower East Side.
Yeah, I have a book because I used to have an office on Center Street.
Yeah.
Of all these little tiny theaters that they had. And now they're stores or apartment buildings and stuff.
But, right, or gone.
Or they're all gone. Yeah, like, but I mean, some of the buildings are still there, but they were transformed into tenement buildings. So I was interested, you know, in that. And I used to go to a lot of theater when it was cheap in like the 70s and like the Ridiculous Theater Company and Circle Rep and, you know, where you could see things for a couple bucks. And I would see all these great Charles Ludlam. Like he was a fantastic, brilliant. He used to like, you know, do everything in drag.
Right.
You know, he would like Irma Vep and his lover. Yeah. But it was just, you'd walk into the theater and you'd start laughing.
Like, right.
Before the show.
Yeah.
But it was a older Greenwich Village, affordable experience.
Yeah.
You know, and if you didn't like it, you only spent a couple bucks.
And that was it. You had nothing to lose.
Nothing to lose.
And even if you didn't like it, it was probably going to be kind of mind-blowing anyways.
Yeah. I kind of think, you know, people have gotten priced out a little bit.
In theater.
In theater especially.
Yeah.
Because that was the thing of seeing something live, seeing somebody, you know, in the cafe or something.
Right.
You'd say, and I, you know, had no money and I could afford to scrape up a couple bucks and see whatever I wanted to see.
So your fascination with this stuff comes from, you know, just growing up here.
Well, I love anything that has to do with the history of things in the past. I think it's... I was a substitute teacher before I went to grad school.
Yeah.
I taught American history. Not that I knew that much about it, but I think that, you know, people think they invented things.
Yeah.
And there's all these instruments like the banjo. You know, the banjo came, you know, from Africa. You know, then
it was
recreated here. You
right.
know? And there's all these instruments that are Mediterranean and Arabic.
There's instruments I don't even know what they are.
You don't know what there's a whole tradition of that. And sometimes I hear certain kinds of music, I'm going like, why does this music like just pulsate, you know, within me?
Yeah.
And I realize, you know, after I did all my DNA and everything, like I have all these different things, you know, strands of different cultures coursing through my bloodstream. And
when did you do that?
Yeah, I did it a couple years ago. And then Dr. Henry Louis Gates asked me to be on Discovering Your Roots, and then I did that show. So they really have an army of people.
I'm doing that.
I can not recommend it more highly. It wasn't what was left for the TV, because you're in there for 3 hours, and if there's three people, there's only 20 minutes of you.
Yeah.
But the experience of being with him and seeing everything.
You were surprised?
I was surprised. And then he gave me more stuff afterwards, because I said, give me everything. I don't care I don't care what it is.
They asked me to do it like 4 years ago, and now it's like finally happening.
It's fascinating.
What'd you find out?
Well, I found out I was a lot of different things.
Right.
I found out that one, I'm related. At the end of they show you who you're related to.
Yeah.
And it's funny because I was on his show and interviewed. I think he must know this because he was on the show. I'm related to Brian Gumbel.
You were?
Yeah, I am. We're like, you know, cousins from a, I don't know if it's on the black side or the white side, but I am. I'm related to him. Yeah. So he's like a cousin of mine.
Yeah, no
I
idea.
Mean, yeah, yeah.
Did you talk to him about it?
No, I want to. I would say, like, you know, we have to have like a cousin meal, you know what I mean? And his brother, yeah. But I mean, I wasn't surprised of all these things,
right.
You know, that I have, because I'm half Sicilian, so I could be, I mean, I could be, you know, Arabic, I could be Norman, I could be Jewish, I could be Greek, I could be Spanish, I could be French. It's all those things. And I have a lot of Iberian in me.
Yeah.
Middle Eastern.
That's wild.
Some sub-Saharan, some Northern African, you know, and there's a lot predominantly of Italian, whatever the hell that means. You know?
But when you grew up, you were just Italian.
I knew that wasn't true because my mother was Sicilian and my father was from Puglia. And when they had arguments, that's in the south too, but it's on the Adriatic. It's two different languages, first of all. And my mother had red hair and was very fair. And, you know, and she was good with knives. So, my father would say these things to her, like you're a dirty Sicilian. And he would say these derogatory, you know, he had a foul mouth. And
sounds like they got along great.
They did. They had a very hot relationship. I mean, no, sometimes they didn't get along, if you're from Southern Italy, it's really the kingdom of the two Sicilies when Naples was the capital. But, Sicily is completely, I've worked there. It's like you're in Africa and you're in Europe. It's its own language.
Is it beautiful?
Yeah, it's beautiful. It's beautiful. It's very mountainous and there's people can be very reserved and then very warm.
Yeah.
But you'll see people with like blonde hair and curly blonde hair and blue eyes. Like with my nose, and then you see people who look like, you know, one of the cast of Hamilton. You know what I mean?
You're right.
Like, well, yeah, and it's like this is all the Sicilian thing, and it, you know, you're very close to Tunisia.
Yeah,
I mean, there's a small waterway, you know. So, and the Arabs ruled there for a long time.
When you went there, did you feel connected?
Yes. Yeah, and in some ways, yes. In some ways. It was foreign, and I mean, I went there in the 1980s.
For the Sicilian?
Yeah, but I learned to ride a horse there. So there was a lot of things that I, and then eventually I felt very comfortable just being in the mountains on a horse. I was a kid who never rode a horse my whole life.
Do you ride now? Do you find?
I still can ride, yeah. Yeah. And I'm going to ride on this, yeah. I kept it up for a while.
Yeah.
But these were great horses. They were Spanish horses.
Yeah.
They were trained.
Right.
One of my horses, his name was Madruga.
Yeah.
And that was a fantastic horse. So, but they were really brilliantly trained horses.
They scare me, man.
You're scared at first, and then you have to make friends with it, and you have to feed it and wash it. And eventually the horse will say, oh, get your smell. And, you know, and then you'll.
You're in?
I was in with my horse. Yeah. My horse didn't want anyone around him after a while. So, but it was terrifying for it. They're big animals.
Yeah, I know, man. Yeah?
And then you're like, you know, and but it's beautiful.
Yeah.
You know, and I got to experience things that I never did.
And you rode recently?
I'm going to ride tomorrow because I have to ride in this other thing I'm doing right now.
What?
I'm doing The Plot Against America by Philip Roth.
Oh, my God. That's a great book.
Yeah.
They're making a movie or a
miniseries.
Series? No kidding.
Six parts. David Simon is the...
David Simon? Really?
Writing. Yeah.
Oh, that's amazing. Yeah. So they're just going to play it real. They're going to do the whole thing.
Well, they're using a lot of footage of Lindbergh
and
certain people.
That's very smart. When did that project start to happen?
I guess there was a few... He wasn't that interested in doing it when Obama was president.
Sure.
He wrote it when Bush was president.
Philip Roth. I know. I read it right when it came out.
When it came out. And it's, I mean, the whole American Firsters, I mean, he took a lot of things that are very truthful. And, you know, obviously history is really revisionist because everyone wanted to be patriotic and fight in the war, but 80% of our country did not want to be involved in a second world war after World War One.
Yeah.
And the level of, you know, there was a big Nazi party here, level of anti-Semitism, you know, and the American Firsters were really, that was Lindbergh's, you know, he was one of those people.
Who do you play?
Of famous people were American Firsters. Vidal was an American Firster.
Gore Vidal his father?
Gore Vidal.
Really?
It started at Yale, of course.
Uh-huh.
I went to Yale as a special, you know, as a drama student. Yeah. I was a handicapped admission. but a lot of things start at those Ivy League institutions of saying, you know, let's keep it pure.
Yeah, it starts at the intellectual level, and then it becomes real.
Let's keep it pure.
Yeah.
You know, this is, I mean, the drama school used to be right next to Skull and Bones, so I had a few encounters with those people over the years.
But they were like a frat, though, really, weren't they?
But you would never see them.
Uh-huh.
You could never see who was in Skull and Bones.
Oh,
it was like a CIA blacked out site.
Yeah.
You couldn't see it. They could throw things over the fence at you, but you would never see them.
But did you feel like it was threatening, or were it just a bunch of kids?
Well, it's weird if you were like a dishwasher late at night and then guys are throwing debris over the fence.
Were you a dishwasher?
I was a dishwasher with me and Charles Dutton. We were both dishwashers at the cabaret and they bothered us one night. So we responded.
Yeah, what'd you do? How'd you fight back the secret society?
We threw things back over the fence at them. I was thinking, but it was odd. Like someone wanted to throw debris on us.
Yeah.
I mean, I was a black guy and another dark skinned Italian Jewish. I could be a lot of things.
Yeah. And you have been a lot of things.
Yeah. And they dumped all this stuff over the fence on us as if it was funny.
Yeah.
It wasn't very funny.
No.
And we didn't think it was very funny. We were working, you know, putting out the garbage.
Yeah.
I remember that, and that left a mark on it. I was like, wow. So this is Yale.
This is the future of our country, the world. These are the world leaders.
Things don't change. I mean, things change, but that's what I'm saying. Going back, you understand what, when you read certain things, you know, if you read about 1924, they just wrote a big article about the immigration laws.
Yeah.
My father came here in 25, but his father had established residency, but they closed the doors to mass immigration, especially Italy, I think, had the most immigrants for one country. There was a lot of Jewish immigrants, but they were in different countries. And my father took him 6 years to get here because they couldn't get in. You know.
That was in 1925?
So he was born in 25, but he got here in 31. But his father had established a residency.
So his father was here?
He had been here a bunch of times. And
What kind of business?
He was a naval officer, but then he went into, you know, he was like a builder.
Your father?
My grandfather. But then they finally got here. But when you read what they wrote about, you know, Italians and Jews, I mean, they were, you know, wow, you just read their description of it about, you know, the interbreeding and the lowering of the, I mean, it was the junk science.
Yeah,
it was
sure.
called, what's the word for
eugenics?
It? Eugenics.
Eugenics. Yeah.
It was the junk science. And they had all these guys and, you know, that's some scientists who were behind it too. And it was eugenics.
Yeah, I can't, you know, it's like getting harder and harder for me to function.
Yeah. Well, but I go back, the only reason I go back is I think, okay, this is what people thought. And then you see people get accepted here and then forget that.
Yeah.
And you're thinking like, you know, you can't forget that, you know, because
this is what America looks like.
This is what it was.
Yeah.
This is that one of the books I really, not to go off on a tangent, but one of the books I really loved about was Nancy Eisenberg's book, White Trash.
Uh-huh.
It's not the most maybe fun book, but she delineates certain things about the whole group of supposedly white people, the waste people.
Yeah.
They were called waste people, the people who came here. They were just supposed to, you know, work the land and then die.
Right.
They were discardable. And they
Where'd
were
they come from?
You know, from England, you know, and, you know, places of whereabout. But these people, they're eventually ones, they became squatters. And they were not landowners. They had no money. And they were lower than slaves. So, of course, they had to have someone to look down upon, too. But she breaks it down about this. And then this myth of whiteness that was kind of laid on. You know,
yeah.
I guess there's a book called When the Irish Became White. I mean, I wasn't considered white until the 1950s.
Yeah.
You I don't mean know
on
about
the census?
No, on the census. You were, my father was other.
Yeah.
He wasn't black.
Right.
Even though he looked, you know, he could have been black. But he was, you had to check other. And then all of a sudden, miraculously, he became white.
Huh.
So I'm just, it just, you know, it fascinates me, the mixture that
sure.
we all are. And I think, everyone, you know, they cling to these myths of things that has nothing to do with who you
got. That's what. Are. That's right. That's what this whole book's about.
Yeah,
a lot
yeah.
of it. Have you always had this thing, this fascination with history?
No, I've learned a yeah. lot more after I got out of school because I worked there.
Yeah,
and people gave me.
Where in Sicily?
I worked in, I did a Primo Levi film with Francesco Rosi, a great director, The Truce, his second book. So for 5 years, he introduced me to Primo Levi and all these things. And I started reading Italian Jewish literature and Italian literature. And I was kind of shocked because a lot of it, it's not, except for a few writers, aren't really translated here.
Huh.
Probably because a lot of the Italians who came here weren't that educated and didn't have a big readership.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, there's so many great, great Jewish writers, but you have a bigger readership, I think.
Right.
You know, people read.
Do you speak Italian?
I've learned to
but
speak present
read?
Tense Italian. I can't read a book.
You right.
know? So I can read an article, but I need a really good translation. But I've devoured voraciously all these Italian, I mean, all those Elena Ferrante books, I devoured all of them, you know, 1, 2, 3, when they came out, because it's interesting, you know, for me, and I've discovered so many great writers. I just did this mini series on Umberto Eco, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, now
Name
he's
of the
from,
Rose.
Yeah, but he's
yeah.
from the Piemontese area, you know, but there are a lot of great Cesare Pavese, Natalia Ginsburg, you know, Calvino, Primo Levi. But Primo Levi, I know all his. I know every book he's ever written.
Oh, I gotta read some.
He's
the greatest.
He's one of the. I've never given one of his books. People would say to me, "Oh my God, I never," because he's not. He doesn't. He writes as a guy who was a chemist.
Yeah.
So he writes everything down in a way that you, even when his worst. His famous book is Se Questo è un Uomo, If This Is a Man, not aptly retitled, or maybe not brilliantly retitled, Survival in Auschwitz here. But he writes it as
I read Survival in Auschwitz.
Yeah, well, that's Primo Levi.
Oh, that's was great. Yeah. That changed my whole perception.
That's it, because he makes you imagine, like, well, what would I have done? It's not about
exactly, and also he sort of I think he introduced the idea that of transcending victimhood from within the camp.
Right.
That this idea we had, they obviously were victims, but there was things going on within the camp on different levels,
on all different levels.
Yeah, yeah,
on
it's a great
all
book.
Different levels.
I don't know and if I forgot that he
yeah,
wrote that.
Yeah,
it changed
that.
My whole brain. That book.
Yeah, me too. I think if you are a prejudiced person, I'm just saying, and you were able to read 10 pages of that, it's a slim book,
yeah,
so pal, like a day, you come out of that, it actually confronts your, in a very, I don't understand how he does it, but subtle way, because it's not about him.
Yeah.
And you feel implicated somehow, or you could be implicated.
Yeah, because he humanizes everybody.
Everybody.
And there's a whole spectrum of emotions and things that people had to do out of necessity.
That's right.
That were fundamentally human just to survive in an almost unsurvivable situation.
Well, he explains it as a laboratory of human behavior.
Right.
And he said that part of his life was really in color. and everything else has been like in, was in black and white. Wow. After that. But he's just, I, you know, once you have an experience with that, it opens something in your brain.
Yeah.
And it confronts you saying, okay, we all have some prejudices, we have weaknesses, we have fears. And that guy, at times when I'm upset about things, whatever, you know, 9/11, election, this, and I'll take one of his essays out and I'll read it.
Yeah.
And I'll say, okay, what does Primo say about this? You know what I mean? And it's like
it's almost like the Talmud or something, the Bible.
Oh yeah, for me. Yeah. Yeah. For me, it is because he's not really religious. And,
yeah.
But he's a humanist.
Right.
You know, so.
So what, like, with this brain that you have that keeps growing, and your interests keep, what compelled you to act initially?
I guess I was in a family with a lot of performers. My mother's brothers were musicians. My mother sang with them and then didn't want to. And she wanted to be a designer, but she had to quit school. And my father's brothers were all very, like, larger than, like, you know, people you would watch in the movies. You would see, well, like, someone like Edward G. Robinson or Lee J. Cobb, for example, or George C. I would, like, say, well, that guy's like my father.
Right.
You know, he's just like my father loved movies. And, I mean, I never
That's
knew
pretty
anybody.
Powerful father. Lee J. Cobb, and were you going to say George C. Scott?
Yeah. My father was, he was right up. That's a combination. Yeah, that's exactly. He even looks like him, you know, like, and I just, and a ferocious temper. But you were around it.
Yeah.
So it was like an acting class. Even my parents, they would go moment to moment, like not let anything pass.
Yeah.
Like, what is that? You know, no, you're laughing. Oh, you think that's funny, right? You're dirty. You know, and it was like, when I went to acting class, I was thinking, well, I've already been in this. I mean, I have my parents.
Yeah.
You know, and so, I mean, a lot of people, I think I'm one of probably many, I don't want to say millions, but when there was a show like The Honeymooners on, that show had an honesty to it that you, if you were a little kid and your parents had that kind of dynamic and you were not well off, you know, my older brother, Ralph, used to call the show Mommy and Daddy.
Yeah.
He said, Mommy and Daddy's on. And somehow, my father didn't really look like Jackie Gleason, but he had the same kind of, you know, slow burns.
Right.
But that show really, there was something about it that had that honesty, you know, above it, and the dreams of, you know, doing something more. So those things affect you, and I think affected a lot of, I know, comedians, but also a lot of actors, and so there were things, you know, there are people that I love, like Edward G. Robinson, you know, I mean, or James Cagney or Betty Davis. I'm just like,
but you were already like, I mean, those.
But I was
were,
a kid, but I used to watch them with my parents on Channel
11
New York
or whatever.
Channel 11, Channel 5, Channel 9. So those movies I grew up with, Warner Brothers movies, then discovered, you know, Brando and all. And then the movies came of the 70s and stuff. So, you know, like, I just showed my son Shampoo the other day.
How do you take, how old is your son?
My youngest son, Diego, is 18. He liked it.
It's a pretty great movie.
And I said that I saw that movie with my dad. And he was so turned on to Julie Christie. He was, I think, you know, you could smoke in the movie theaters.
Yeah,
stuff.
Yeah.
But I remember I kept looking at him, thinking like smoke was coming out of his ears and stuff, you know.
So those were the inspirations.
Well, those things. And then you know, I started seeing theater and I thought, well, maybe I could do this. And then I went to college.
So you went, where'd you go to undergrad?
I went to SUNY New Paltz.
And that's where started acting?
Yeah. And I had a lot of great teachers there because it was close to New York.
Yeah.
And I had a couple of teachers, Richard Bell and this guy, Joe Paperone, and this woman who went to Yale, Beverly Brum from Wisconsin.
Yeah.
And she, and they really kind of, I don't say civilized me or educated me because I was just so raw, you know, and.
But passionate.
I was.
You come from the craziness.
I was shy.
Yeah.
But once you let me do it, only when I was comfortable.
Right. Well, I mean, do you find that like growing up in the volatile house that you grew up in, that you were always second banana or third banana?
I was watching it all.
Right.
I was studying it
but
all.
But could you speak up? I mean.
Sometimes I did. Yeah. Sometimes I spoke up for my mother.
You right.
know what I mean? Against my father.
Oh, yeah.
Things got out of hand. Yeah. So, but.
What, was he boozy or?
He wasn't boozy, but he could be.
Temper.
He had his. he had his rages. And,
oh, yeah.
You know, and men in that generation,
yeah.
It's a different world.
Yeah.
It was a much more, you know, women were, you felt the oppression of a household,
uh-huh.
You know what I mean? Especially in the culture that I was in.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It was, you know.
Italian-American?
I used to go to my friend's house who were Jewish, and they were like, I said, well, your mother, you know, she's the one who's the force in here.
Yeah.
In our house, it was like dad's home.
How many kids were there?
There were three of us. Three boys.
You have an older brother?
I have an older brother, Ralph, and Nicholas is my younger brother.
I saw Nick somewhere recently
at
the airport or something.
But you know, everybody's house is not like normal. When we grew up in TV, reflection of family, except for the honeymoon was all like my three sons.
Right, yeah.
And so we all somehow got this thing of like, well, we want to be like American normal people, and none of that existed. You know what I mean? I remember my father saying that to me. I said, why can't we be like those people on television? He was like, well, it's not real. It's not real. I said, yeah, but people don't go flying out of windows and, you know what I mean, and all kinds of stuff. He goes, it's, you know. I remember like a funny story. I was telling someone that we moved.
Yeah.
We lived in Hollis, Queens.
Yeah.
And it was basically mostly black neighborhood.
Right.
So my friends were all black.
How old were you?
We moved. I was around six.
Yeah.
But those years are really formative years.
Sure.
So, you know, it was a very close, we lived in garden apartments.
Yeah.
So everybody was outside. We all played on the street. It was, you know, everybody played with each other.
Yeah.
It was, you know, the hula hoop, chubby checker, you know, the crystals, you know. And then when we moved to Rosedale, and that was mostly a Italian, Irish, little Jewish neighborhood. And I was dark, and all the kids thought I was Puerto Rican. And there weren't many Puerto Ricans in that neighborhood, you know.
Yeah.
That was kind of a term, like if you were Puerto Rican, you got picked on by the Italians and the Irish.
Yeah.
You know, because it was like the Irish were here and the Italians, and there was someone else to pick on. And
keep moving down.
Yeah. And you know, I was, a lot of the kids would invite me over and then kind of beat me up, gang up on me. And I don't know, I was around 7 years old or something, and my father was home watching Edward G. Robinson, who's one of our favorite actors in The Seawolf,
right,
by Wolf Larson, where he plays the terrible captain who's a sadistic guy. He throws Barry Fitzgerald to the sharks.
Yeah, yeah.
John Garfield is in it, Ida Lupino. And anyway, I came in and I was 7 years old. I was in tears. These kids had thrown water balloons at me and were hitting me and saying my mother was all kinds of things. And I didn't know exactly how to respond to them. And my father, I came in and my father told me to be quiet. He said he was watching a movie. And I said, Dad, can I talk to you? And he said, you know, no, I'm watching Edward G. Robinson. And he was fighting the entire crew. And
right.
Anyway, I told my father, I said, listen, these guys beating me up, both of them. And he said, well, how many are there? And he said, well, I said, there's two of them, and they're older than me, and they're beating me up. And they invited me over. And then he said, you know, look at Edward G. Robinson. You know, he fights the entire crew. Whatever he has, I see, you know, bites and pulls hair, kicks, anything. So he said, well, he said, if there's more than one guy, then even it out, get a stick. And I did.
You got a stick.
And I did, and I had a pretty brutal fight with both of them. They were pretty tough kids.
Yeah.
And one kid I bit really badly.
Where'd you bite?
On his arm.
Yeah.
He had to get butterflies, I remember.
No kidding.
He had to get butterflies.
They stitched him up?
And the other kid, I smacked him with this stick really head, and I just pounded both. I mean, I don't know, because I was so emotional, because they were like torturing me.
Yeah.
And, you know, and then, of course, the parents came.
Yeah.
My mother had to go out. My father was still watching the movie.
Right.
Didn't bother him. It didn't bother him at all. But it was so strange moving to this neighborhood where I was supposed to be with people who were supposed to be like me, and they're the ones who, you know.
But they didn't fuck with you again.
No, after that they knew, like, but you know, steer, you know, leave me alone.
But was that out of character for you on some level?
I wasn't like that kind of kid. I wasn't a kid.
So did it hurt your heart?
Yeah, yeah. And I've been in some fights, you know, over the years when I was a kid, and I was always, took a lot out of me. emotionally.
Were you able to make an amends?
Not to them, I wasn't, because I saw how brutal they were.
So they had it
brutal.
Coming.
They were just brutal.
They were bad kids.
They would try to rip your hair out of your head. And
yeah.
So I was like, all right, well, no, then if you're going to, it's not, you're not giving me a fair chance.
And, right.
But not only that, I was trying to make friends.
Yeah.
And they were like, no, just so trying sad. To, yeah. You know, when you're a kid, you know, kids are very...
Brutal. Harsh.
They're really cruel.
Yeah.
They know how to, you know, I was saying to someone the other day when I was a substitute teacher, at two different schools, Rice High School and then this school, Our Lady Queen of Martyr. I was fifth and sixth graders, and there was a girl who was a great student.
Yeah.
Her name was Maria, and there was a boy who had problems. I won't say his name. And but he liked Maria. But this girl was, she was in fifth grade, she was really ironic, she was a great student and so graceful. And the last day of school, he liked her, and he was emotional because, you know, I was kind of had gotten to like me, and he reached out to her and he grabbed her pigtails, like he yanked her on the ground, like pulling her hair, as if to say, like, you know, I like you, but like a caveman.
Yeah.
And she was in pain, and I went and I had to break them up, and she never let out a sound. She just looked at him like, you know, like she felt empathy for him.
Yeah.
And I couldn't believe that she had like tears in her eyes and stuff. And she didn't like discharge on him at all. It was such a informative moment to see some kid who had problems and this girl who was so graceful and didn't make him even feel worse, even though he hurt her, you know? And I just thought, wow, that's something I have to remember. You know, and because sometimes you do these scenes and you go like, it was such a psychological gesture and her response was so exceptional.
Because she was empathetic.
She just, I'll never forget how she looked at him. I'll never forget it. I thought highly of her, but after that I was like, wow, this person is really special.
So it's got me upset, or in a good way.
Yeah.
But I mean, you had this, like, you had, it seems like a very full life to enter the acting world in. And when you were at New Paltz, you did some stuff in high school.
I did stuff at some plays in high school. Did like Pippin and stuff like that.
And you loved it.
I really liked it. But the first play I did in New Paltz was One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. And I had a little experience with being around people who were suffering from mental problems, my own family down the block.
Yeah.
And,
who in your family?
My older brother, Ralph.
He's still around?
Yeah. I'm his guardian. And, we're close. And,
yeah.
And he's a very talented guy. And, but he's had, I guess, diagnosed with everything, basically.
Right.
From schizophrenia to obsessive compulsive, and he's been in and out of institutions, and you know, the mental health system is hard for anyone, even someone like myself who has some money to navigate. You'll try to help him, and after my parents died, it was quite hard. But I, you know, I had to go to court and everything to become his guardian, and a lot of times the state becomes the guardian because the siblings just can't, you know, you get worn out.
Yeah.
And, it's not like these movies when there's someone overcomes it.
Most
of this is a lifelong, endless baseball season that never ends. And I never spoke about this until I did this speech, Catherine Burns at the Moth.
Yeah.
I'm very happy I have. And I've been involved with this Community Access, which has helped my brother a lot. They supply housing and programs, and it's a great organization, and we're trying to raise money to build more buildings now, and we're doing that. So it feels good.
How often do you see him?
Pretty often when I'm in town, pretty often I take him out, you know, and we walk around, and
he's level.
Make sure he showers and stuff like that. he's, you know, I've come a long way.
Yeah.
He's in a more peaceful part of his life,
which
I'm very, very
happy about. Oh, really?
I've been through, you know, the police.
Oh, really?
And I've been. Oh, yeah. The whole.
Oh my God.
I mean, people don't realize the families, you know, who if you have a family member, what you go through
yeah.
as a family member, it scars you.
And when this is a whole your whole life?
Since I'm 12 years old.
Different phases of it?
All different phases of it, yeah.
Oh, it's
yeah.
so hard.
It's such a hard, and that's why people run for the hills. And so maybe it made me more empathetic or, yeah. or whatever, you know.
Like to see that much raw emotion and that type of human behavior, it's got to be somewhat like a powerful study of something.
Yes. I mean, I think we learn the dynamics, whether you're an actor, a comedian, yeah. a writer, you know, between your parents
yeah.
and your siblings. And my parents, I saw that they were,
yeah.
you know, my father was like a very expressive, unconscious, like childlike man in some ways, but he could be scary. And my mother was very quick. And
well, you seem to have it pretty well integrated. I mean, you're not saying he was abusive or anything
well,
like
he,
that.
He had his moments. He right. had his moments, but he forgiving. Wasn't consistent. I was yeah. forgiving of that. I mean, you know, you have to kind of make a list or do a mathematical equation. How much of it is it?
Right.
You know, is it 50-50? Is it 75? You know, he was in World War II, suffered from his nerves,
yeah.
post-traumatic stress. He was in D-Day, all that stuff. But, you know, in my parents and their interplay,
yeah.
I saw the, you know, it was like going to a Sandy Meisner repeat exercise class. You know, they didn't let anything pass. You know,
you're
they
right.
were like, you know, and my mother knew how to try to defuse things, and you know, she was just very you know, she was a period, she had a hard life, but she had a really optimistic spirit, and I think that really affected me.
Full balance.
Yeah, because I really felt like she was so talented of a person, and I feel like I wish I was as talented as she was, but whatever opportunity I have, I really feel like my mother could have done so many things, but because she didn't get certain opportunities or whatever, and I, we were very, very, we had a very close friendship.
Oh,
very close friendship.
That's
and
nice.
I was really, it took me, when she passed away, it was a huge, I had to really kind of recalibrate my...
How old were you?
I was 2000, I don't know, maybe I was late 40s.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So, but I mean, but we were just, you know, we had a, you know, she went through a lot of things.
Yeah.
But, you know, she was a really fun person.
Yeah.
Like a person who, I'm glad I was able to get to share
things
with her. And, you know, you are...
And she got to see some of your success?
Yeah. Yeah, and she was, you know, she was, and she would be honest with me too. Sometimes she'd say like, "Oh, wow, you had no chemistry. Like that was a fake kiss. I saw that when you kissed that." And if I had chemistry with someone, she would say, "Oh, you know, don't let your wife see that." You know what I mean? She knew right away.
Yeah.
I was like, "How do you know these things?" She goes, "I know you." You know, she was like, "Yeah."
Yeah.
Yeah. One time I said, I mean, I used it in a movie that I did, Romance and Cigarettes. Like, I was like, well, you know, it's hard to be married and you look around, you know, and it's like, you know, you go through these like ups and downs. And my mother was in the car with me. She goes, "So, all right, so you want to go do something else?" She goes, "Yeah, well, what do you think you're going to find there?" She says, "It's not like a, you know, machine where you put in, like you get M&Ms and chips." She said, "It's the peanuts are going to come out." She said, "It's the same peanut bag that comes out." I was dying. I said, "I can't believe you said that." I said, "So, you know," I said, "Yeah, but there's different color hair."
Right.
You know. She was like, "Well, it's the same thing."
Yeah.
"You're not going to find anything new. What do you think you're going to find? Something new?" You know? And she was just like, she spoke from experience.
She saved your marriage.
Yeah, yeah. So I was like, you know,
that's a good lesson to learn.
Yeah. I was like, wow.
So in the training, like with in undergrad, well, I mean, like you had good teachers.
I had great teachers. I had Beverly Brum, Joe Paparone. I had Richard Bell, and Beverly Brum was very helpful. She went to Yale, and you know, I was really, really close with her. And you know, it's funny, you people, when they talk about all these different, I was thinking about it because Pulse was so relaxed. I mean, people used to go skinny dipping, and then you'd meet people and you'd be naked, you know. So, you know, it was, but Beverly was from the Midwest. She was gay.
Yeah.
And here I was, this kind of big, you know, muscular kind of Italian guy. And
yeah,
she really educated me, and I would do anything for her. She just, and, you know, she gave me parts that were hard for me, and helped me in my writing. It helped me what to read.
What was the biggest challenge?
I loved her so much. And she always came to all my plays up until she passed.
What was the biggest challenge for you initially? What had to be cracked? I think
being confident, not feeling that I was sophisticated, not being well read enough.
Right.
I just felt I was like sensitive.
Yeah.
And I could feel when I was not up to snuff, or being, you know, well, I would get nervous about stuff and not want to embarrass myself.
Right.
And then, but once I got in there, then I didn't feel the same. I've always been better with one-on-one with teachers, not in a classroom.
Yeah.
Unless they gave me a text or something. And then I studied after college with a man, Robert Modica, who was worked with Sandy Meisner, and he made a huge impression on me. So when I went back to Yale, I was pretty well trained. I was better trained than most of the people in that class, I would say.
And you did a lot of theater here with the West Beth and everything.
I did a lot
else.
Of theater, but I had good training. So then I could take, you know, the vocal things and the movement things there. And I got to work a lot at Yale with a lot of very talented people.
And who was in your class again?
I said Charles Dutton, Angela Bassett, Sabrina LaBeouf.
And that's where you met Francis too?
Francis was a year ahead of me, and that's where I met Joel, and Joel would see me in plays. And
had they made movies yet?
Well, when she did Blood Simple, I went to see that, and that's where I met Joel and Ethan. And then I had done this play at the Eugene O'Neill Center after Yale, that Lloyd Richards, who was the dean of the drama school, was the head of that. And I met John Patrick Shanley, and I did Danny in the Deep Blue Sea, and did a bunch of things with John, including Five Corners, which a lot of people saw me in, this kind of explosive King Kong kind of character. And that's where Spike saw me. You know, he was like, man, I saw you throw your mother out the window. You know, like I said, listen, Shanley wrote that. I said, I just did it. So, but Joel and Ethan knew my work through that and also through theater.
But Spike and those guys, you're their guy in a lot of movies.
Well, I've been in, you know, they're
a lot of Spike.
I consider
movies.
Them a lot of Spike movies. I've worked with Joel and Ethan four times, but in the theater with Ethan, and they executive produced Romance and Cigarettes.
Oh, okay.
With James Gandolfini and Kate Winslet.
God, it's so sad he's gone.
I know. I was saying to someone the other day, Steve Zaliot, I said, you know, James is one of those people that I still can't get my head around.
Yeah.
That he's not here.
Yeah.
He just had this, I don't know.
Did you know him a long time?
I knew him. I knew because I know him through Aida.
She's your cousin. Right?
And they did Streetcar Named Desire when Alec Baldwin was Stanley. And then, this, you know, from The Sopranos and stuff.
I got to be honest, Barton Fink is one of my favorite movies ever. I think it's one of the best movies ever.
Well, it's a good movie. So I can say that now.
You can say that now.
Yeah. It took me a while to, you know, understand like what everyone really liked about it.
Really?
But, yeah. I mean, I love doing it. I've never not had a good experience working with.
But there's a guy who loved those movies.
Yeah.
When you were a kid, I mean, there must have been some connection.
I mean, yeah. I mean, that was. I mean, I loved the script and everything.
Yeah.
But, you know, when you're not used to seeing yourself in those things. So,
right.
You know, it's. But I remember lines like. From the other characters.
Right.
Like, you know, Ben Geisler, you know, you fucked him, Fink. He had a heart as big as all of the out, he had a heart as big as the all outdoors, and you fucked him, Fink. You know,
why did it take you a long time?
Because you're just weird seeing yourself in these things or whatever. You're like, I recently saw some of it. I was like, well, this is really, I mean, I knew it was brilliantly made and designed.
What's it like working with them in terms of like, what's the relationship like? What are they?
We have a great relationship. We have always had a good relationship.
Because a lot of these characters, they're all different. And, you know, and I mean, in
they
Spike
wrote
too.
Barton Fink for me, and they wrote Miller's Crossing for me.
Okay.
And they wrote.
Well, that scene where you're about to, where you get killed in Miller's Crossing, right? In the woods, right?
So they wrote those things with me. But I, you know, when they do that, then I try to do a lot more work and surprise them a little bit because, you know, they're doing something for you. And they're just great guys.
They're very meticulous, right?
Really meticulous.
Yeah.
Really. I remember when I did Miller's Crossing, I showed him a picture of Leopold and Loeb. I think it was Loeb. And I said, that's how I want to look, just like that guy. And they were like, all right. You want to.
What about the character in Old Brother? That was like, that guy was volatile.
Yeah, that was just, you know, based on Curly. You know, I don't know. I don't know where I pulled that. I mean, I worked on the accents. I don't know where I, but they, you know, they give you a lot. They say, well, could you shave your head? What about your teeth? Can we get really bad teeth made?
Yeah.
And once I put the teeth in my mouth, they had the accent. And then I realized, like, I'm just going to be. You know, he's like a guy who's always suspicious. He's the suspicious guy.
Right,
Tim
right.
was the innocent guy.
Right.
And George is the brains of the operation, so to speak. You
right.
know? So it was like a three-headed monster. And but
you were thinking, were thinking about the Stooges?
Yeah, I was. You know, I was like the sway back. You know, like I would do these like outrageous things just to make Ethan like. You know, yeah, because they like that kind of stuff too.
Yeah, know? They like broad, like they not like, broad, but like big characters.
Yeah, but you got to kind of get. And that's a little more stylized, but still you got to get, you know, into the spirit of each individual thing. It's different. Each one of their movies is a little different.
And Lebowski was crazy. Yeah, that guy, so, that's a crazy character.
You know, I mean, that's the character I kind of had, they saw me do something like that on stage.
Oh, they did?
Yeah, and they were fascinated by that. So I thought it was going to be a much bigger character originally when I did it, I was like, well, I better make something out of it. So, but listen, I don't know. I didn't get that movie when it first came out, but I have to say, like...
The Lebowski?
It took me a while to really understand the humor.
Yeah, I'm still trying to get it.
Yeah.
Because people love it. It's like got a cult following,
because
and I keep watching it, and I keep going, like, well, how come I can't...
You have to want to be a child. Like, kids like it because if you never want to grow up...
Right.
If you want to stay in your pajamas...
Right.
Jeff is the guy, like he's like, you know,
it's a whole generation he represents.
He represents the underachiever,
right?
You know, the classic underachiever.
Right.
I mean, when they wrote it, they said, "Well, it's like a Cheech and Chong film." They were telling me, you know, and I was like, "But Jeff, I think is just great in it. He's just like I always, you know, got him, but now I get the movie a lot."
And what about like like, what's the relationship with Spike? How's that different?
My relationship is very, very good with Spike. I mean,
how's he
we
work?
Grew up very, not that dissimilar. He grew up in Italian neighborhood, grew up in black neighborhood, you know. I got bussed out to an all-black school, you know. By the time we met, it was weird. It was almost as if we were like...
You knew each other?
I have my own relationship with him, and I've played the racist guy, the anti-racist guy, the cop, you know. I've been accused of all kinds of things, but we did know better. So I've seen, you know, the white establishment response to Spike from the beginning.
And
I know him as a friend.
Yeah.
And I know what kind of person he is.
Yeah.
He knew my mom. He knew my brother. And so, you know, he's feisty, but he had a big knapsack on his back.
Yeah.
And I don't think a lot of people knew that, he was trying to say, I can make a black film and people will go see it.
Yeah.
And it was, at that time, you know, it was after the blaxploitation type of films. And, you know, he opened up a big door. And he opened up a lot of opportunities for a lot of people. But he's someone I consider a close friend.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm going to maybe do another movie, hopefully, and would be like the executive producer on it because I've been working on a movie about basically something I want to make, but it's about like ignorance.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And openness.
Uh-huh.
Like both, you know, because I think sometimes you see these movies and it's like too clear between the good and the bad.
Right.
There's not this gray area, the
complexity
of a guy.
Yeah.
Well, how can a guy in the same family vote for this person or be a complete anti-whatever he is,
right.
you know, and the other person is not that way at all.
Yeah.
And you come from the same parents. Yeah. And I think therein lies the debate.
Yeah.
And not this hardening.
Divided. Right.
There's nothing that's going to happen that way. Yeah. Only it's going to be people screaming at each
other. Is it a family thing you got in
mind? You have to do it through, through a family.
Right.
The most horrible deed, Arthur Miller, because he, loved the Greeks, the tragic deed.
Yeah.
Or the most ridiculous deed is done within the family.
Right.
Always.
Yeah.
That is, that's the world. That's your world.
Right.
View. You know, when you come out of it. And so it's something hopefully I'll get a chance to make.
Are you writing it?
Yeah, it's all done. It's all done and I hope to do it.
Oh, that's exciting.
Yeah. So that's, but I think this blindness that we see right now. I think a lot of what's going on in the world has to do with our culture. I really do.
With America.
Yeah, I think it has to do with our culture.
Oh, yeah, that's what that book's about. Fantasy Land. You guys, it's
our culture.
Yeah, and now it's so weird because, when you deal with the political climate we live in this particular president, there's something, sadly, painfully honest about that guy being the president.
Yeah. Yeah, it's shockingly,
he represents all the worst of us.
Yeah. I mean, he... Listen, reality television helped him hone his persona, which he always had.
Did you know him?
No, my father worked for his father.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And, didn't know him that well.
Doing construction?
Yeah, because my father was a builder.
Yeah.
Yeah. My brother worked for Trump as a doorman.
Which one, Nick?
Nick, as St. Moritz.
Yeah.
So he has his own, but... his father basically enabled him.
Yeah.
He's enabled him. But I think when being on TV all those years, people's idea of him, not in New York City.
Yeah.
Because I don't think he could even win borough president.
Right.
I don't know. Maybe he could win in Staten Island, but he wouldn't win it in Queens.
Yeah.
And he wouldn't win it in Brooklyn. He wouldn't win it in the Bronx. And he wouldn't win it in Manhattan.
Yeah.
So that says a lot. And this is his hometown. But people...
Bought it. Yeah.
For 12 years. Don't forget, it was over 10 years. He was the mastermind.
Yeah.
So that just goes to show you. Now, of course, the guy who created that show is not from our country. He was English.
Yeah.
The guy who created that show.
Yeah.
So maybe the Revolutionary War is still, I don't know. But I was thinking like, wow, not an American didn't do that. But I.
Murdoch's not American either.
No, either. Yeah. I know that. And I think there's something in that also.
Sure.
I do. You see, I watched a lot of those Republican debates with my son because we thought they were entertaining.
Yeah.
But he's a bully. He's always been a bully.
Yeah.
And that's what he is. He's a bully.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's why some people I look at him, I say like, wow, I can only think of like mud wrestling as an answer to everything. Mud wrestling. It's like that. But that's what happens when someone's been enabled,
sure,
to a certain point. But what I fear about is like everything is anti knowledge, anti nuance,
it's anti science, anti-rationality.
Reason. The book I just made, the Name of the Rose, that's what the book is about.
Yeah.
It's about. The guy's a man of faith, but a man of science. The guy's a philosopher, but he's a man of action. The guy understands the value of women, even though he's with all these men, all these monks who fear and demonize women. And he understands more than anything that the only power against absolutism, this is in 1327, and Umberto Eco is a pretty smart guy, is knowledge. That's the only thing you have. So if you burn those books... Well, if you suppress those books, and really it was the Arabs who saved all this Greek literature, they translated into Arabic and then was retranslated back into the Latin. That's the only thing you have against they call it the Antichrist, but against of any form of absolute power.
And now they don't have to burn the books. You just offer a lot of alternative information that seems to make sense.
So I think that is the big issue, that if you're against you know, the power of knowledge. I mean, why do people, when you go to a doctor, you want the doctor to have gone to medical school.
Yeah.
So why would I ever listen to a politician when it comes to, you know, the atmosphere?
Yeah.
No, I'm going to listen to
a scientist. Sure.
You know what I mean? So, yeah. I mean, they're the biggest actors imaginable. I mean, when I look at politicians, I go, wow.
Have you ever played one?
I'm playing kind of a politician now in this.
In the plot against America?
Yeah, he's the rabbi who's he collaborates with Lindbergh. So he's like a politician.
Right.
You know? But like a lot of people, they believed, you know, America should be isolationist. But when I watch politicians, you know, I think about what is the believability factor. Like, I can tell you anything. I could do all these things.
Yeah.
But can I do any of those things?
Right.
I mean, and you see how hard it is, even with the brightest people, when they reach out and the other people say, well, no, we're not doing anything. I mean, look what happened with Obama. It's like, as soon as he reached out, they were like, no, you're not getting anything.
It's sort of amazing to see how desperately people want to believe and how easily they do believe if it matches up with their particular emotions.
Well, this
and they
is,
just allow themselves.
They allow themselves to just be tenderized, I think.
Yeah.
Like you're tender, and then you're going to be put right on the flame.
Yeah, yeah.
You're going to be cooked.
Mm-hmm.
And you're going to, and he's going to eat you.
Mm-hmm.
I just hope that it doesn't turn out that people start attacking each other, the people who are almost on the same side.
Yeah.
You know, I fear for that, to say you got to get united for the overall, the best possible outcome and good.
Yeah.
You know? And
as when you do, like, it sounds like these are, like, even that the night of was a fairly provocative.
Well, I try to do stories when I can that has humanity and has complexity. Yeah. Because all these issues are complex.
Yeah.
There's no, you know, black and white answer.
Good and evil.
No, it's so simplistic. And I think, once again, our culture loves to, you know, they always say, well, the character has to change. You know, nobody changes. Nobody changes. They can grow. They can enlarge.
Right.
But your basic nature is kind of set.
Yeah, you can make different choices.
That's right.
Yeah.
You know, and I feel like sometimes pop culture could help that in a way by just getting people to reflect a little bit here and there. I mean, you can do your little thing, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't like when people tell me who to vote for and stuff. I try to study, you know, and read about people and say who actually could get something done.
Right.
You know. And,
yeah. And maybe they will. Maybe they won't.
Maybe they will.
Yeah.
So it's.
What's it like being a father of, like, kids?
Well, I have two boys. One's 28 and one's 18. And, I, you know, like to leave the world a better place.
How are they turning out? They're all right?
Yeah. One of my older boy works for DC Comics, and my younger son is going to go to college next year.
Oh, yeah? So, what's he interested in?
He's really good in math. He's really good in history. He doesn't know yet. You know, my other son's the artist, and so he doesn't know. But he's a smart guy.
When you do all these characters, I mean, does it, like, obviously they're coming from you, but you're such a thoughtful guy. I mean, how much of an impact has, you know, getting into the heads of these characters, like, evolved you?
Well, you make a list sometimes what you have in common, what you don't have in common, you know. And
was that something you do to prepare?
Sometimes I do that. Yeah, sometimes I do. I say, well, this is what I need to work on.
This interesting.
Is something I, you know, these things I understand, this I don't. And once in a while, you just connect with everybody. Like, if you're the director, like with on the night of, with Richard Price and Steve Zaillian, we had no question about the sensibility of it and the world of it. And I interviewed so many lawyers, and some really successful lawyers. And one
just
guy,
as research?
Research. One guy, Kenny Montgomery, he looks like Idris Elba. He's
he's
a star a defense attorney. He was a prosecutor. He helped delineate what he goes through in a trial for me, and I saw him interview people, and so little by little you Frankenstein it somehow, and then sometimes something occurs and you're like, wow. The great thing about that character, he's like an everyman, because he's a guy with all the potential in the world, but he doesn't have, like, the stomach to be successful. And that's a lot of very talented people. They don't
what do you
have
think
the
that
stomach
is? in that sense. They don't have the stomach.
Some people just can't maybe hold someone's life in their hands, or they can't take the punishment of rejection.
Right.
You know?
It's a sensitivity.
And, yeah. And fear. I mean, in my business, fear. You have to be really sensitive when you work. And at the same time, you have to have a thick skin.
Yeah.
People are going to say, you know, no, I don't like you. Yeah. I don't like this. I don't like, and they're like, and it is kind of personal. You know, it is you, you know, you're like, wow. They said, I'm, you know, I mean, I've had critics write about my face over the years. I mean, not lately, but when I was younger, and I was like, God, really? And I was like, I have a lot of girlfriends. I said, you know, girls like me, but these guys are writing about me. Like, then I realized that, like, you know, that's their freaking problem.
It is
their
problem.
It's their problem. It's not my problem.
Have you ever had problems with directors?
I mean, listen, there are a lot of directors I would work with anytime, and I only got to work with maybe once. But yeah, sure, I've had problems with, you know, now I know how to, you know, I mean, I worked with Michael Cimino and Billy Friedkin when I was a young actor, so
I've interviewed Billy Friedkin. I know him. Yeah, he's something.
He's pretty wild. So those movies were a different kind of, you know.
Yeah.
It was a lot of cocaine-driven general type of idea. You know, I have an army, and I was, you know, shocked doing those movies. I was like, wow, people.
That was To Live and Die in L.A.?
To Live and Die, I know, was The Sicilian.
Oh, The Sicilian.
I learned, I much rather work with people who are passionate, but who are gentle.
How's Redford?
Loved working with him. Loved working with him. We were in love with each other.
Yeah.
I loved working with him. I mean, he was great. He was great. I was on that movie. I was the only actor for a long time.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so I spent a lot of time with him.
Yeah.
So now I've never got to work with him again, but we got along really well.
And you do like smaller movies too, like with people. I saw that movie Landline. I thought it was great.
Yeah.
I like that movie.
I mean, you want to give different people. I work with young filmmakers, you know, and you never know. You know, you
and
never
do you
know.
Like directing?
I do. When I'm with, if I have enough time,
yeah.
You know, and when I'm with great, you know, but some of the movies I've made, they're very much, they're very dear to me. You know what I mean? And I'm proud of the films I made.
Well, I hope you get to make this new one.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks for talking to me.
Okay, thanks for having me.
So that worked out okay. That was me and John Turturro. The Name of the Rose is currently airing on Sundance, and you can watch episodes on their streaming service, Sundance Now, or at sundancetv.com. I will play a little guitar for you. Oh, to answer a question for people asking, the tone that I'm getting out of this thing is really just the amp. It's an old, I think it's a 57 or 58 Fender Deluxe with one big 10-inch speaker in there. I'm using an Echoplex pedal and a Les Paul Deluxe, a gold top with P90s. So, you know, you crank that amp and it breaks up pretty nicely. There's no tone pedal involved here, just the Echoplex. I'm talking like, you know, like I'm a professional guitar player. It's the only pedal that I don't really know how to use a lot of them. Anyways, it enjoy this meditation.
Boomer lives.